Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Americans consume. That's what we do. For today's Morning Macro with Joe Santos, we look at how the U.S. consumer drives economic activity, and you can follow along with our conversation online at schooled.blog.com. And when you do that, you get the charts and graphs that go with what Joe Santos is about to talk about, color-coded to bring everything home and ease your learning today. Joe is professor of economics and Dyckhouse scholar of money, banking, and regulation in the Nest School of Management and Economics at South Dakota State University. And he's joining us from the Janine Basinger studio at SDSU. Hey, Joe, welcome back.
Thank you, Lori. Great to be back.
And these visuals are particularly effective. All of them are, but these ones are just kind of have a wallop to them because you see how much consumer spending is driving the economy overall, which, you know, I don't know. Am I the only one that surprises a lot? Maybe I am.
Well, it's we hear a lot about how the American economy is driven by the American consumer, but I agree with you. Until you look at the graphs or you look at the data and you realize just how much of a share of gross domestic product is in effect purchased by households. And by the way, when we talk about expenditure, consumer expenditure, we're referring to what households do as opposed to, say, what governments do in spending or firms do with spending. So, it's a little more than two-thirds of all the spending that takes place over any one year.
And I think maybe I've told you this story before, but the first time this message ever came home to me was after September 11th and the terrorist attacks and President George W. Bush at the time coming on TV telling people, get out, live your lives, go to Disney World. And it was because he said that Disney World that my ears perked up and was like, what? What is he talking about? And that was the moment that I thought, wait a minute, this whole economy depends on me getting out and spending money. Well, it never had occurred to me before he laid it out on national television that there was a lot at stake if we all kind of hunkered down and did nothing for too long.
Yeah. If we think about gross domestic product as sort of the goal posts, if you will, and then we recognize this fact that consumer expenditure is roughly two-thirds of all of GDP, then it doesn't take much to get from there to recognizing that if this consumer expenditure were to diminish dramatically, you'd have a lot of stuff piling up on store shelves. And my suspicion is that firms would respond to those unintentional increases in inventory by reducing inventory going forward. And so, you know, this can have a sort of a chain reaction, as it were, in the economy. It would have effects in labor markets and so on. So, the story you recount is one I remember as well. And, mentioning Disney World in that context maybe was not the most timely way to do it. But it is an empirical fact that much of gross domestic product consists of household expenditure.
Right. Barbers are out there waiting to cut your hair, and shopkeepers are waiting to sell you your peanut butter and your apples, and Disney World is waiting to punch your ticket. So, all right, let's start with last Friday because we have new numbers that sort of fuels this conversation. What did we learn on Friday?
Yeah, so on Friday, the U.S. Census Bureau reported that what it calls its advance estimates for retail and food services sales. Reported numbers, various ways of cutting up these data, as you can imagine, but reported them for November 2019. And this is what sort of motivated today's topic for me. The numbers, and again, there were a lot of them, but they were mostly underwhelming, given that November is such a crucial holiday season shopping month. Most market watchers were expecting something stronger. And so this leads us to this larger issue. The advance estimates data are survey-based. But so then what I do in the blog is take a look at just actual expenditure. And as we said, it's a large share of GDP. But most importantly, because most of the time we're thinking about the growth in real GDP over time, you know, an interesting question would be to ask, OK, well, consumers matter a lot. But what about the growth in the economy? How much do they contribute to that growth? And so if you look at, let's say, 2018, real gross domestic product grew by about 3%. And about 2% of that was the growth in consumption expenditures. So they're not just a large share of the economy at any one moment in time. Again, those area charts you're referring to on the blog, where you see this big color, amber color, that represents consumers. They also, over time, contribute the majority of growth to the growth in real GDP. So if what we're interested in doing is growing the pie, if you will, then consumer expenditures drive that growth in the overall size of the economy. And so when we saw these numbers on Friday, and these numbers are very volatile, they tend to be revised rather dramatically. So I don't know that there's too much to say so much about the numbers themselves. But it concerned folks who were looking, again, as you said, for the almighty consumer to sort of save the day in November. And that's not exactly what the numbers suggested.
All right. So what are consumers consuming?
Yeah. So the way the Bureau of Economic Analysis, and so everyone else, breaks this up is into durable goods, thinks refrigerators and automobiles, non-durable goods, peanut butter and apples, and then services. So everything from haircuts to root canals. Sorry for that example. But
right.
So those are the three areas. And then of those three areas, services comprise the largest share of consumption expenditures at any time. And you can go back in the data and you'll see that this is largely the case, has been the case for many, many decades. So services are most important in terms of a share of consumer expenditures. And then you have durable and non-durable. What's interesting, though, is that the durable consumption expenditures are the most sensitive to the business cycle. So when the economy expands or the economy contracts, consumption expenditures expand and contract. But when you get a little more granular, you realize that it's actually durable goods expenditures that mostly expand and contract with the economy. And if you think about that for a moment, it makes a lot of sense, right? I mean, haircuts, root canals, apples, peanut butter, these aren't the consumption decisions we really make with the phase of the business cycle in mind.
Right.
So these are relatively smooth, we say, over time. It's really durable good consumption that is volatile, or at the very least sensitive to the economic environment more generally. So if we're going into a recession, for example, people keep buying groceries, they keep getting haircuts, but they may not buy refrigerators, or they may not replace the furnace in their home. Mm-hmm. Those are the kinds of consumption expenditures that are most sensitive to where we are at any point in the economy. They're sensitive to interest rates because, again, often those sorts of purchases are financed and so on. But overall, if you just add those three components up, in general, consumption expenditure is not terribly sensitive to any stage of the business cycle. The exception, as always, right, is the Great Recession. There's a chart there you can see where consumption expenditures dropped a little bit during the Great Recession, but the durable goods component really collapsed during the Great Recession.
So that means people are not like me, where I only replace those things when they break. Other people just upgrade their fridge. Is that what
you know, that's a thing.
Like
it turns out.
I just wait until it no longer works, and then I wait for nine. I don't, you know, I haven't fixed my oven for 9 months. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Other
but,
people
but when
just
you
make
do,
purchases because they want to or can, I guess.
Yeah, and they you know, get a sense of the economic environment in which they're making those purchases and decide. So you may not have replaced the refrigerator and the oven yet, but my guess is when you do, you
right.
may take into consideration these other macroeconomic features.
Well, now I will. Okay, so before we go forward, let's go back a little bit because you mentioned root canals, and I'm thinking of services and I'm thinking of healthcare because that's mm-hmm. That's not a small amount of money anymore. It's not like getting your hair cut or getting the oil changed on your car or, you know, some other service that you might think is, you know, mm-hmm. pretty stable. How expensive does healthcare have to get before we start seeing people not spending on it because they're making different financial decisions just because they can't?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, if we're thinking about healthcare, something like that root canal, which probably is preceded by a toothache, I would imagine your demand for that is, as we would say, fairly inelastic. That is, you'll pay any price to alleviate the pain. And so what this could do is shift consumption expenditure patterns. So as healthcare increases in price for the consumer, my guess is in many cases, as I say, the consumer may not so much do without the health care, but they may do without other expenditures that they may have engaged in had their budget allowed for it. So it's an interesting question when you see something like healthcare, very inelastic, you know, no substitutes for that sort of thing available. You see those prices rise. What you tend to see, and you don't see these in the aggregate data, of course, are these shifts between various goods and services where consumers are essentially trying to make do with the income they have and the access to credit they have and so forth, and still pay for some of these, you know, extreme necessities.
Right. When does that become part of the economic conversation? When everybody's, you know, how many people have to be paying how much of their expendable income on healthcare before it becomes, you know, an impediment to the rest of economic growth? Do you see what I'm asking there?
Yeah. It's, you know, I know this isn't the most the sort of richest answer, but analytically speaking, if healthcare expenditures become a larger and larger share of consumption expenditures, what we'll see is a shift, not just in terms of the purchases, so buying less peanut butter or apples, let's say, but of course, demand and supply respond to each other. So over time, you would see an economy that is increasingly dedicated to you know, the pursuit of producing healthcare in some way, shape, or form, and less dedicated to producing other sorts of goods and services. So again, I know that's sort of beside the larger point you're getting at, which is how expensive does this have to get before we do something about it? And I think, you know, listening to political debates and so forth right now, we're certainly having those conversations because a lot of households are feeling constrained by the cost of health care. But again, very sort of antiseptically, if you will, looking at this from 35,000 feet, at the very least, what will occur over time, what must occur over time, is a shift not only in consumption patterns, favoring, let's say, healthcare expenditures as a matter of necessity, but then also the economy itself becoming a larger and larger producer of healthcare. And I think we're observing that, if only anecdotally, you know, just in our everyday lives, observing the extent of healthcare services available in our life.
Sure. All right, so let's talk a little bit about how we kind of look at this in the sense of measuring out our income and this notion of consuming your permanent income. Tell us, read that sentence for us and tell us why it's so important, because it's in there twice.
It's in there twice, right? It's so important, the reader needs to read it twice. So consumption smoothing is a term economists use, which essentially refers to this idea of not so much consuming portions of your actual or current income, which as a practical matter, of course, that's what you do. But what you're really doing in your head, if you will, is you're consuming a proportion of your permanent income, which of course begs the next question, what's permanent income? And the way to think about this is, you know, imagine your lifetime earnings and then turn that into an annuity, if you will, so you get this annual payment equivalent to your lifetime earnings. And that's really what you're thinking about is at any moment in time. So if your current income is above that level, you probably save a bit and still live in a way that's, let's say, consistent with your permanent income, your lifetime earnings. Likewise, if your current income falls below your so-called permanent income, well, this is where smoothing consumption again comes in to say, look, just because I have no current income, I'm not going to starve now and then you know, eat well when I actually have the income. I'll just consume in a rather consistent way over my life. I'll smooth consumption. That is, I'll consume in a way that's consistent with my permanent income. So necessarily speaking, then, individuals who do smooth their consumption over their lifetime, which is essentially all of us, likely go into debt at times and then other times save into the future, as it were, either pay off debt or just save absolutely in order to provide for themselves in the future. So, you know, I'm on a college campus. I see a lot of students and students who are, you know, living reasonably well. I mean, they have coats for winter, they have functioning automobiles and so on. These items may not be consistent with their current income, but, you know, on some level, they're being perfectly rational, recognizing that this isn't the only income they'll ever have. Their permanent income is greater than their current income. And so they'll essentially borrow against their future. And so this is where we get into household debt, this sort of rational explanation for household debt is that individuals are, again, if you will, smoothing their consumption over their life, and they have determined, and that's the tricky part, that their permanent income exceeds their current income and they are justified in borrowing against their future. Again, that's a very sort of a rationalization of going into debt, I know, but that's the way we often at least think about it as a first pass.
Right. But that also brings up the concept of a home mortgage or a student loan as well.
That's right. So if we look at household debt right now, and there's another one of those area charts on the blog where you'll see that right now, roughly the household debt is about $14 trillion. So real quick arithmetic, $14 trillion, GDP is about $20 trillion. So you're upwards of two-thirds of GDP in the form of household debt, just as a comparison to GDP. And to your point, much of that is mortgage debt. And then that's followed by student loan debt, auto, credit card, and then other, which can include personal loans and so on. And if you look at the chart over time, you'll notice that debt had increased in the lead up to the Great Recession, and then households tightened and tightened budgets and debt fell. And then it's begun to rise again. But as we've talked about in other contexts on this program before, the most sensible way, I think, to think about household debt is to divide it by disposable personal income. And when you do that, you get a very interesting picture. And it's one that shows that since the Great Recession, household debt as a share of personal of disposable personal income has actually come down quite a bit. In fact, far lower now than it has been for decades. So it's not to say that the household balance sheet has deteriorated since the Great Recession. On the contrary, it's actually, in this context anyway, improved. Because while debt has increased, so too has their disposable income. So as a share of that income, it's actually come down. You can do the same with debt servicing costs. So just, you know, the monthly payments, as it were, divide that by their disposable income. And again, there you'll notice that as a share of their disposable income today, households are, you know, writing checks for mortgage loans and auto loans and so on to the tune of about 10% of their income, which is at an all-time low. The data go back to about 1980, and they've never been that low. So households do go into debt. American households do it quite well. But compared to the last few decades, debt as a share of income, debt servicing costs as a share of income are actually not on the rise. On the contrary, they've come down quite a bit.
How much of that can you break down to, you know, these are the effects of what we learned from the Great Recession and how families have sort of responded to it versus what's available? You know, they couldn't get the loan, so they don't get the loan.
They don't get the loan. Yeah. And they're sort of self-insuring. Yeah, that's a really good point. There are a couple things going on. We know the saving rate has increased since the Great Recession. I think that's very much in line with what you're suggesting, a sort of a new way of thinking about debt and household budgets more generally. Debt has increased, but again, not as a share of disposable income, again, suggesting a kind of austerity, if you will, or you know, being more careful with their budget. And then we're also living in an environment of exceptionally low interest rates. So the cost of servicing that, this doesn't affect the level of debt, but it does affect the cost of servicing that debt. So I think there's the sort of mental framework, if you will, where folks are thinking, I'm not doing that again, and they're being more frugal. But then just as a matter of arithmetic, interest rates are lower. And so the cost of financing that debt has come down as well. So I think it's both.
So we talked about the Great Recession. What about other times in history, you know, post-World War II, or times when, you know, the message, you know, 1970s, and I mentioned George W. Bush, but how about Jimmy Carter, you know, in his sweater in front of the fireplace saying, you know, save a little money. Were there other times in American history where that consumer spending decreased, and we see that in a measurable way?
Yeah. So I'm glad you ended it with an immeasurable way. So Jimmy Carter's sweater didn't have quite the measurable impact in the data. But
politically, it did for him.
Politically, for him it did. Unemployment came quickly. But yeah. For the macroeconomy, the Second World War is an interesting case. So if you do the very same sort of area you know, graph for the end of the by the end of the Second World War, consumption as a share of GDP is only about 49%. Again, the number today is something like 68%. So it dropped during the Second World War, and that's sort of, you know, obvious reasons, because there are so many other priorities, commitments, and so forth that don't include peanut butter, apples, haircuts, and, you know, the other silly things we've mentioned before. And so you're shifting the economy toward an industrial military economy. And so you see that by it happened throughout the war, but you see it in the data by about 43, 44, where consumption as a share of the economy shrunk. But that was a sort of an exception. It's sort of a V, you know, the bottom of the V, and then you start to come up again. And today we're at levels that we would have been, say, prior to the Second World War, up around the two-thirds, 60, 70% of GDP.
Yeah. All right, so I'm walking you toward this whole, you know, finale here in our final minutes, which with the Jimmy Carter question is that, you know, you go back to World War II, and, you know, we had somebody on the program the other day who was talking about, you know, growing up in South Dakota and picking up every piece of scrap metal for the war effort. You have Jimmy Carter who, you know, talked about conservation and saving energy with immediate impact to his political future, although some would argue he became more effective as a leader outside outside the White House.
Sure.
You know, George W. Bush after September 11th, you know, reminding people to keep being Americans, go out and do what Americans do best, which in some ways is consume. And now we're marching toward this sort of climate crisis and this idea of consumerism becoming, taking on a meaning beyond simply keeping economic growth going. Also, it sort of has this connotation of waste. And I'm just wondering where we're headed with, you know, what happens if people decide to consume less based on their fears or their sense of moral responsibility for, you know, for what they're consuming, or how does it just shift to where they're spending their money on other things like solar panels, or does it contract somehow and have a measurable impact on the economy because people have decided to do something different with their checkbooks?
Sure. Yeah, that's a really important question and raises all sorts of ideas. But very specifically to the question of what does it do the moment you buy solar panels instead of an SUV, the short run, it will disrupt. There's no question, because there are supply chains, production processes in place. There are inventories of goods that are now being frowned upon. The purchase of them is being frowned upon. So in the short run, I know this is the typical macro answer, you know, it's always short run versus long. But in the short, you can immediately change the composition of production to reflect consumer preferences. And so you will see adjustment costs, to put it sort of mildly. In the long run, I think you got right at it in your question. In the long run, you would see the composition of the economy more appropriately reflecting the new preferences that you described in your question of consumers. And, you know, we'd be fine. We could measure GDP, we could measure its growth, we can do all of this and still emphasize the importance of economic activity, but it would all be with this, say, environmental mindset in mind. So both things are can be simultaneously true in the long run. But in the short run, again, as a practical matter, it would be disruptive. That, not arguing that it's a case for not doing it, but we know there would be disruption. And the disruption would be proportional to this suddenness of the change. You know, if the change is foreseeable over the long term, that's one thing. If it's between Tuesday and Wednesday that we don't want SUVs and we want solar panels, then you're going to see a larger disruption. But you certainly would see some adjustment, to put it mildly, in the short run.
So is it safe to say that if consumers make that adjustment, it happens more slowly than if the government makes the adjustment through regulatory functions?
Both have costs. It's a good question. I think if consumers abandon a particular type of product, you know, it builds up an inventory and some firms take the hit and the adjustment is borne that way. If government attempts to sort of regulate the good or the service out of existence, that also imposes regulatory burdens, tax wedges, regulatory wedges, as we say, the wedge comes between, you know, the economic activity. And so there are burdens or costs to both. Ideally, what we'd like to see, you know, the sort of the easiest way to do it is the way you're suggesting: consumers who simply express different preferences, and then an economy that adjusts to those preferences over time. If you are going to impose government, that also can be a solution, but it will not come without cost, because, again, it will impose some sort of Well, it will impose on the economy, and it may even impose various regulatory burdens, compliance burdens, and those sorts of things. So neither one is costless, and I'd be lying if I could identify the one that would be cheaper in this one particular case, but it's a great question.
Consumers are that powerful.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
That's the key takeaway here.
I agree.
Joe Santos, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Lori.